Okay. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Susan Brock. I'm academic manager at the Institute for Advanced Teaching and Learning, and I've been involved with the OLSL project from before its inception, in that I helped Jonathan Neilan write BID, and I've been working with it in a variety of capacities ever since.
Okay. So what are your what is the link between Capital and OSL?
Right. Well, the Capital Centre was set up to look at the ways that performance, first of all in the most sort of theatrical sense and then in a rather wider sense, was relevant to teaching and learning and how it could be used in teaching and learning at higher education level. And that developed into a concept which has been called by us and by others open space learning, which involves both, I suppose, in theatrical terms, the use of open spaces, the sort of theatrical spaces that we have or we had at the Capital Centre and now are using in IATL, a rehearsal room, that is an empty space, a really empty space, rather light but empty, and a studio with reasonably rudimentary lighting and sound and so on, but reproducing that idea of a studio theatre. So theatre spaces, first of all, is open spaces, and then that developing into any sort of space that didn't create a divide between teacher and learner. And secondly, open space in thinking about the way that one approached the transfer of knowledge, both between teachers and learners, but between learners themselves, in terms of kinesthetic learning, applied drama, and so on. So it started very theatrical and has opened out from that. And the idea of the Open Space Learning Project, for which we applied for funding from the Higher Education Academy, was twofold. Was one, to extend the life of the work of the Capital Centre beyond the 5 years of HEFCE funding, and secondly, to attempt to embed it more effectively in the university. After perhaps, I suppose, under the Capital Centre, it was a 5-year project. We spent the first 2 years trying to find out what we were doing, and then the last 3 years putting that into practice. But these things, we have discovered, take a long, long time. And in fact, one of the interesting things is that the effect of Capital is almost more noticeable now that Capital doesn't exist anymore, and that's part of, I think, the effect of the continuation of the Open Space Learning Project.
So contrary to Capital, the OSL had a running start.
Yes, it did, because it built on and on what Capital had done, and part of the BID made the case that what we needed to do was to further embed that practice that had been developed through the Capital Centre. And we were able to say, because of the decision of the university to set up the Institute for Advanced Teaching and Learning, that we actually hit that objective at the end of our first year. So that was very satisfactory. And having set that going, it was much easier to continue the work. One of the areas, though, that one, I think that I regret, is that we haven't yet very actively brought into the OSL community more departments that we hadn't worked with in Capital. The sort of follow-on has been very useful in that we had people who we knew were interested in our methods, who tried some of them out, that we've been able to develop with. They've also got data about their own students, we hope, that dates from the Capital days, so gives us some sort of longitudinal element to the study as well. So that's been very helpful.
Are there any particular landmark successes with regard to the OSL project as you see it?
Yeah, well, I think the greatest successes have been, first of all, the publication of the book, Open Space Learning, which again came out of Capital, but a sort of crystallised the thinking that is behind the Open Space Learning project that we're working with now. I think that was a very large one. I think the work with Ethnodrama, that we've done, which was which we hadn't really explored very much under Capital. Claudette Bryanston was one of our fellows in creativity and developed some early work, which is now going forward, both as a OSL project, in that we're funding the completion of the play that was built on her ethnodrama research, and that's also being supported by the Institute for Advanced Teaching and Learning to actually roll that out into the university through the Institute of Health Supply Drama Group, which was rather moribund, and it's being used to sort of give that a lift. So that's a very nice sort of area of continuity. And also the work that Manushka Bailey's done with us, which was not an area that we had particularly planned to push forward into. We had been looking at ways that Warwick's creative writing programme could work with researchers to create a piece of performable text, and that wasn't possible because David Morley, who's director of the writing programme, who was going to lead on that, then was on study leave and then on personal leave over the duration of the project. So we had to reform that. And Anushka Bailey, who is a practitioner in her own right, but also writing a research thesis in theatre studies, has taken that and actually done something very interesting. Still, I think, at an embryonic stage, but it shows what can be done. And more importantly, that there seems to be a real hunger from students to do this sort of work outside the curriculum. It's very difficult when we've discovered when you're running projects that aren't linked to a module or to a course and are assessed, to get students not to sign up to them, because they do, because they're interested in there's a very wide pool of possibilities, but really to ensure that they stick with the project to the end, because as soon as external, you know, their curricular pressures are on, they will drop the extracurricular work. And one of the things that Anushka's project did was to show that, you know, if you've got the right sort of commitment and the right sort of work, you can actually carry that sort of project right through to the end and to a very fruitful end. So ethnodrama, the book, and the other area, which I think is probably slightly still embryonic but there's lots of potential, is breaking into some new areas like maths and psychiatry. And so, you know, we can see that we are going forward. It's not just a matter of sort of paddling around in the same pool, but we're sort of getting out and, you know, sort of walking off a little bit. So that's been very useful. And it's also, those two areas, I think, have also provided us with some reproducible guidelines about how you might get a foot in the door of some departments that just don't feel that open space learning has anything to say to them.
Yeah. You mentioned the difficulty of extracurricular OSL activity. I was wondering if you could comment on what might be seen as the resistance of certain departments to OSL, or the resistance of departments who embrace OSL, but resistance to the assessment elements of OSL, or the idea that you might incorporate it fully in your curriculum,
right,
make a central academic component.
Okay, well, if we just go to resistance first, I think we have the change in terminology has partly been to counteract that sense of performance, which frightens most people. And, you know, we have, when we're talking about what we do, nearly always put in a rider saying, this does not mean you have to act, we're not expecting actors, we're not asking you to perform in a theatrical sense. And open space learning, I think the terminology is much more neutral, and also it allows for a multiplicity of approaches. What we always said, even in the days of the Capital Centre, is that this isn't the only way to teach. It is one of a variety of strategies, and open space learning offers teachers a variety of strategies. In terms of the difficulties in embedding open space learning, I think there are two. One is that experienced teachers, or teachers at any level, on the whole, haven't done this sort of work before. So they're having to change their teaching methods very drastically. And there hasn't been any infrastructure really to help them do that, apart from working with the OSL and the capital team and observing and then gradually sort of absorbing it into the bloodstream and then trying it out. But where we've worked, even with when we were working with the Royal Shakespeare Company under Capital, where we were working often with drama teachers and English teachers who often had a personal interest in performance of some sort and may well have done some acting and all the rest of it, after we'd run workshops, the response often was, "I found that really interesting, but I don't think I'm ready to go and do it now. I need a bit more sort of training, a bit more support." And that's what we haven't been able to provide in the structured way that we'd hoped, because we were, as part of the OSL project, we had posited this idea of creating a postgraduate certificate in higher education workshop leadership. For a variety of reasons, the university preferred not to support it as a PG cert, and we're now going to run it as part of the Learning and Development Centre suite of courses, and it will be interesting to see if it works that way. I mean, we've got the first one at the end of this week, next Monday, and the numbers are very, very small. That's partly because it's part of the LDC programme, it's not pushed out to people, people go to it. And so we're just now starting to try to just, you know, reach people who've expressed an interest and said, "You might not have noticed that this is going on." So I think there needs to be more support. The other thing is in terms of assessment. And I think, again, it requires different assessment methodologies, that if you're going to ask students to learn in a different way, to absorb information and to use information in a different way, and ideas and themes, then at the end of it, getting them to write a 3,000-word essay or whatever isn't always appropriate. So once you step out of that box, then it opens up all sorts of issues in terms of balance between examinations and assessed work and so on. But what we did find in the days of Capital, that when we actually interrogated the university's regulations on assessment, in fact, although the word examination is used, which implies that everyone is going to sit in one of those huge gyms and write things for 3 hours, in fact, examination can be construed in a number of different ways. And so we've developed assessment methodologies, or adapted them quite often from drama and theatre studies, that allow students to work more creatively, we hope, so they're less confined within the structure of the assessment, by using reflective diaries, by using presentations more. But all of these things, increasingly, when one talks to colleagues throughout the university, lots of departments are already using elements of those. What they haven't really thought about is how you apply that to a different sort of teaching. So I think in terms of changing the assessment regime, that's going to happen sort of little by little. And certainly I've been doing a lot of work with the business school, and they, you know, the business school teaching is very much set up around case studies and oral presentations and so on. So, you know, and that's not, it's not in any way foreign or frightening, or it's just the way that they teach their subject. And so I think it's a matter of moving across the disciplines and being more interdisciplinary about assessment, as well as being more open to different ways of doing things.
Yeah.
But rigour is the thing, you know, that people who object to changing the methods of assessment, what they talk about is a loss of rigour. And there's anxieties about group assessments as well. But there are ways and means around that. So it's a question, again, it's like performance, is that if you just sort of unpack all of that and explain how it works, then it can be very adaptable and to fit into, you know, the most sort of conventional scenarios, if the will is there.
And we have that happening in the business school.
Yes, well, one of the projects we're working on is a module called Critical Issues in Law and Management, which has now been running for 3 years, and that has worked and based on existing practice, but I suppose the difference is what the module leader has done is to bring in colleagues who have a performance base to their work and use that to help the students actually up their game in terms of the way they approach their work and the way they present it as well. So rather than just standing up and doing a PowerPoint as they used to, they're encouraged to be much more inventive and involved in it. Now that sometimes works and it sometimes doesn't, and as well I have been talking mostly about resistance from staff, but I have to say there's also resistance from students of course as well, because on the whole in a university like Warwick, that most students who are here because they're good at traditional forms of learning and they're very good at remembering things and they're very good at writing essays and exams and so on, and then suddenly being taken out of their comfort zone and made to do something that they feel both emotionally and psychologically they don't want to do because it's laying them on the line, you know, there's always a sort of rump that don't like it and don't enjoy it, and also, to be honest, may not be good at it.
Yeah,
there are different ways of doing things. So not everyone is going to take to this and find that it enhances their teaching and learning, which is why one must always look, I think, at a multiplicity of learning styles. Otherwise, we just, you know, it's just we're just setting up, you know, the traditions of 10, 15 years when everybody's going to say, do you know, it'd be really good to have a lecture. That'd be innovative, wouldn't it?
And do you think that, how do you envisage the future? When the OSL project finishes in July, do you think that open space learning will sustain itself in this university?
I think it will in pockets. One of the most interesting things that's happened actually in the last week was the fact that the university's director of estates came to the launch of the open space learning book. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the university is looking at its at the estate on the whole, and certainly in the new refreshed university strategy under the student experience, the fact that the university was improving and enhancing its buildings and that the learning spaces were, you know, state of the art and comfortable and interesting and challenging and all the rest of it is very high on the university's agenda. We've talked to the committee that oversees estates generally, and there has been an interest over the last 3 or 4 years in the way that we're using different sorts of spaces to teach in. And, you know, the beginning of that is the refurbishing of some existing teaching rooms with movable furniture so that you can actually push things back and create an open space. I think almost that sort of interest in the infrastructural part of the university might actually carry on longer than some teaching which is based on individual teachers committing themselves to do this. So I think it will have a life beyond, and I think the continuation of the Institute for Advanced Teaching and Learning will provide that continuity, because open space learning or performance based learning is one of the areas, thematic areas, that we ask people to address when they're applying for grant money, for example. So there is a way of supporting it. What there might not be in quite the same way is a sort of proselytising element. It will just be one strand amongst many, so that's quite problematic, I suppose, and that partly depends on people. I mean, I think the whole, you know, if it has a weakness, both Capital and the OSL project and OSL within the Institute for Advanced Teaching and Learning very much depends on the people who are available to work with us and who work in those teams, and without them there are other people outside, but you know, we have that core, and if that core were to be dispersed, I think there would be a loss of momentum.
And finally, you mentioned regrets earlier actually, but I was wondering, any lessons learned, any particular lessons learned, if you were to begin this project again, would you do anything different?
No, I don't think so. I think when you write these applications for funding, you do have to do one of those little risk management things. And the risks that have that actually turned into threats have been, one, the loss of David Morley, which meant that we had to sort of restructure slightly. Secondly, the fact that Jonathan Nealands, who's our principal investigator, is also involved, has been involved in this second year in another project, which is quite time-consuming, so that his attention has not necessarily been as focused as he would have liked it to have been. I think the whole idea of lead learners, which wasn't part of the original bid, but sort of developed through it, I do think it's a really good idea, but I don't think we've handled it well. And I think that's partly a function of the circumstances in which OSL has worked in the second year, is that everybody, I hope you're not going to actually record this bit, everybody's eye is off the ball a bit. So that in order to really get the best out of student involvement, you really have to work very closely with them. And I think the project leaders, in some cases have and in other cases haven't, and which means that the students, you know, not quite sure what they're supposed to do, they haven't been pushed to complete things and so on. So I think it was a good idea, but, if I were to do that again, I would certainly do it differently if I had the time to do it. I think that's about it, really. I think, on the whole, it's been remarkably successful. And the other thing that it's shown, up to a point, is that you don't need a lot of money to do it, because we will have a surplus. Not a huge surplus, but we will have a surplus. On the other side, I think there are some areas of activity that are resource-heavy, and I think it's probably 99% certain that without the OSL resource being made available, either people or money, they won't continue. But in fact, you can do an awful lot with not very much. It just needs the will to do it.
What was the most, capital heavy investment then?
Chemistry. We had a lot of money for, what are they called? External consultants and And to be honest, the people we know quite a lot of people working in this area, and most of them are quite happy to just come and talk for nothing. You know, so that whereas when you start talking consultants, you're talking in the £2,000 a day league. And in fact, you know, most consultants working in open space learning on the whole are practitioners. And, you know, if you pay their fares and give them lunch and perhaps a couple of £100, that's all you need. But it does need some resource. Certainly, and you need to sort of refresh the gene pool. That's the other thing, I think, is that, you know, we live in this little OSL bubble where we all talk to each other and we all sort of pat each other on the back, and you have the usual suspects, both in terms of teachers and learners, that sort of keep propping up. We do need to break out of that, and that's why it's such a shame that PG Cert didn't get off the stocks when it did, and I'm just concerned that if we don't get, you know, more than half a dozen people next week, then, you know, there's no incentive to do it again, and that just means then you've got no support. Interestingly, that the meeting I went to, the space committee, which is occupied by various people, well, like the director of estates, the dean of the medical schools, they're the chair of the board of graduate studies and so on. The dean of the medical school asked me. He said, this isn't a question about the spaces, but we're very interested in doing this sort of teaching, but what I've got is a staff that don't know how to do it. How are we going to, you know, how are we going to support them? And I said, well, we're going to be running this this workshop. In fact, no one from medical school has signed up, and I've actually just emailed him and said, you know, I know it's a bit late in the day, but we are running this, and please, you know, spread that out. So I think it could just sort of die a death if everyone leaves and then there's absolutely no money. But at the moment we're not in that situation, so what we do need to do is just to keep pushing and get more people involved, I think.
Try to establish an apostolic succession.
So, but there, you know, there are lots of people out there doing interesting teaching, and one of the things that IATL can do, and I'm sure will do more of, is actually bring those people together, because I think there are people actually doing open space learning out there, but they don't know that they're doing it. And if we could just sort of find them and get them to talk to other people about what they're doing, then I think, you know, it's not all on our shoulders. I mean, at the moment, you think, well, if it wasn't for Nick and Johnny and Jonathan and you.
Do you think that there's a claim to be made that open space learning is taking place in traditional spaces as well?
Oh, absolutely,
so that, you know, a lecture can actually turn into an open space. I had a lecture yesterday, and the lecturer, she was a young PhD student, and she got everyone to stand up and and to read a poem, you know, a line that went round the hall, and it was quite effective.
Absolutely. As I say, I don't think... I think the danger is that open space learning just sort of builds a sort of a fortress round it and says only the people who come in through the front door are allowed to do this and know how to do it, and there are things that, you know, we don't approve of. And I think, I don't think it should work like that at all, and if it does, it is going to die a death.
It becomes oppositional.
Yeah, it's got to be out there, and I think this is why just sort of getting people to talk to each other about their practice actually opens up all sorts of doors. One of the things that I've used, and I'm, you know, I'm not naturally an open space teacher, is just using warm-up exercises. It's just to get students to talk to each other, or stand up, or breathe, or do anything apart from sit there, open their books, and just wait for you. And so I think, you know, there's just small things that you can do that you can start off.
And this is where this is where the architecture is important.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, in the English department, people teach in very small offices. You can't even get people to stand up.
It was the old tutorial, you know, because it was the old tutorial system that's just been sort of put on steroids, and more people shoved into little rooms. It just doesn't, you know, doesn't work. But the as Carol has said, you know, lots of times when talking about capital and OSL, this isn't a cheap way of teaching, because it does work better in smaller groups. But there are ways you can do it in a lecture theatre. But, you know, the other side of it is, you know, I gather the business school has applied for a 600-seat lecture theatre. Now, you know, you could do OSL in that, but you have to jolly well work at it. And it takes a certain sort of teacher. So, you know, we're looking at not just OSL, but also teaching that perhaps isn't quite as good as it might be. So, you know, we've all been to lectures where the lecturer comes in, takes out the file, and takes the file up. They've just taken out the filing cabinet, it's been there for 20 years, opens it up, and then reads the lecture. And yet, and then you've got, you know, lectures where you've got people who go in and perform their lectures. And even though the students might be sitting down, there is performance going on there. There is a sort of contact between them. And so, you know, if you can get people to engage... I think, you know, engage is perhaps a word as much as open. It just makes that connection. And the physical connection is easier to make once you've broken down those barriers. But if you make mental connection, then you've sort of got halfway there.
And I think often these kinds of projects are instituted in order to filter through this way ideation rather than substantially, you know, in the sense that, oh, here's an open space learning space.
Well, we want to be able to do it everywhere. And so, you know, I mean, even, well, not even, but in the days of Capital, or even now, with the writer's room, I know George Tooley takes his students out. David Morley would take his students out into onto the campus and teach them, you know, while walking, or teach them while looking at the woods or whatever. It's just thinking of teaching learning in a different way. And I think the one of the sort of threats, or the criticisms of it, is again coming down to rigour. Is this just doing primary school, let's all go for a nature ramble, or is it let's all sit on the floor and tell a story? And it has to be done at an appropriate level, and that's you know, the area of tension when we worked with the RSC, is that although they had terrific skills in terms of using performance, in terms of content, because of the nature of the work that they did was mostly schools based, and there wasn't what we failed to do working with actors was to raise the level of content to a sufficient standard for undergraduates. So the way that what we were expecting was that we would go to actors and we would somehow help them to raise their game in terms of content, or if not actors, people working within the theatre. But in fact, the way it worked was that the techniques that the actors used were adapted by academics. So they had the content and they overlaid that with the techniques rather than the other way around. That's not to say it can't happen the other way around, but on the whole, the travel was, in terms of theatrical techniques, to academics rather than from academics into the theatre.
I suppose that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It was sort of disappointing. We hoped it was going to be a two-way street, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
And that doesn't apply to every individual on either side. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, that was the sort of trend.
The way it was going.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. That was very good. Thank you very much, Susan.
How many more have you got to do?
I'm going to